Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday the 23rd of June, these are our main stories. The US Coast Guard says all five people on board a submersible that went missing near the wreck of the Titanic have died in a catastrophic implosion. The former Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro has gone on trial, charged with abusing his power and spreading false information about the electoral system ahead of last year's poll. Human Rights Watch has urged the United Nations to intervene in Sudan's Darfur region amid evidence of growing atrocities against the non-Arab population there. Also in this podcast, fear and loathing in the ring.
Is that... Are
we really going to see Zuckerberg and Musk slug it out? We begin with the story that's gripped many people around the world since Sunday. The fate of a submersible craft that had been taking tourists to the wreck of the Titanic deep down in the Atlantic Ocean when contact was lost. On Thursday afternoon, local time, the US Coast Guard confirmed that debris discovered on the ocean floor did belong to the Titan submersible, which had disappeared. A remote operating vehicle had been sent down into the ocean to find it. In total, five people were on board. The chief executive of the company behind the trip, Stockton Rush, is among the dead. Three British nationals and a French former Navy diver were also on board. The firm, Ocean Gate, said all five shared a spirit of adventure. The search coordinator, US Rear Admiral John Mauger, addressed a news conference in Boston, the centre of the operation.
This morning, an ROV, or remote operated vehicle, from the vessel Horizon Arctic discovered the tail cone of the Titan submersible approximately 1,600 feet from the bow of the Titanic on the seafloor. The ROV subsequently found additional debris. In consultation with experts from within the Unified Command, the debris is consistent with the catastrophic loss of the pressure chamber. Upon this determination, we immediately notified the families. On behalf of the United States Coast Guard and the entire Unified Command, I offer my deepest condolences to the families. I can only imagine what this has been like for them, and I hope that this discovery provides some solace during this difficult time. Additionally, we've been in close contact with the British and French Consuls General to ensure that they are fully apprised and that their concerns are being addressed. The outpouring of support in this highly complex search operation has been robust and immensely appreciated. We are grateful for the rapid mobilization of experts on the undersea search and rescue, and we thank all of the agencies and personnel for their role in the response. We're also incredibly grateful for the full spectrum of international assistance that's been provided. The ROVs will remain on scene and continue to gather information. Again, our most heartfelt condolences go out to the loved ones of the crew.
US Rear Admiral John Mauger. Our correspondent Dan Johnson was at the press conference in Boston.
Even this morning, the Coast Guard was still speaking of this being an active search and rescue operation, of there still being hope, there still being time. This is when everybody was talking about the ticking clock in terms of the amount of oxygen that was perhaps left for those men enduring some sort of suffering being trapped on that craft. But it turns out that that wasn't the case all along. Every sign now is that they died pretty quickly in something instant, sudden, powerful, early on in the dive. Every sign is that that happened happened probably at the point where communication was lost, an hour and 45 minutes into their trip down to the wreckage of the Titanic on Sunday morning. It looks like they didn't even make it to the Titanic. The debris that was found this morning by those remote submersibles working down on the seabed was still 500 metres short of the Titanic wreck. So it looks like the five men didn't make it to the Titanic, that they lost their lives suddenly in something, as the Coast Guard describes, catastrophic, probably to do with some sort of pressure overload that will have happened very suddenly, very powerfully, and means that they lost their lives quickly. And everybody here absorbing that news now, the hope has gone. There is going to be no rescue. Those men are not going to be returning to their families. That is something for people here, for their friends and colleagues and the deep dive community to absorb. And then perhaps there will be wider questions about the safety of this sort of activity.
Dan Johnson in Boston there. Well, the oceanographer David Mearns was a friend of one of those who were on board the Titan sub, the British billionaire Hamish Harding. Mr. Mearns gave his reaction to news of his death and all those on board.
It's the worst possible outcome, all five men not being able to come home. It's what I feared when I got the first call on Monday about what had happened. Initially, that Hamish was in the sub, and that how it was lost communications, first dive, Titanic. That was not good. All of us in the deep sea, subsea community understand the risks. And when you get news like that, it hits you in the pit of your stomach, and particularly when it's a friend. And then later in the day, that PH was on board, PH Nargile was on board with Hamish. Then it's a double blow. I don't know Stockton Rush. He's part of my community. And then to hear that a father and a son were doing this dive on Father's Day is also gut-wrenching, isn't it? And what we're learning today in terms of what they're seeing on the seabed confirmed what a lot of us feared right from the beginning. And the only solace in any of it is that they didn't suffer for 4 days. But still, the outcome is the same. Five men are not coming home, five families and are devastated, and we're left questioning, you know, why did that happen?
The oceanographer David Mearns. Well, there have now been calls for an inquiry into this incident, especially the design of the submersible. Guillermo Sernlein, co-founder of the OceanGate company and who no longer works for it, has defended how the minisub was built.
Everyone's got different opinions on how subs should be designed, how dives should be conducted, how expeditions should be conducted. That being said, developing innovations in any new technology, including submersibles, means that sometimes you have to go outside of the bounds of the regulatory scheme.
The BBC's science correspondent Jonathan Amos told us more about how this sub imploded.
They found the debris about 500 metres away from the Titanic itself. This is in an area which is known to be quite debris-free from that event back in the early 1900s. They found the struts underneath the sub. They found an end cover, a sort of a slightly superficial cover that's on one end of this cylindrical-shaped sub. But they also found, critically, these two titanium end caps. So you've got a carbon fibre cylinder. Carbon fibre is very strong, but the titanium on the end is really, really tough. And they have two hemispheres right on the end. A normal sub, deep sea sub, those two titanium end caps, those hemispheres, would be joined together because that would equalise the pressure all around. Just pushes and pushes and pushes. It's 4,000 tonnes per square metre at Titanic depth. So they will be asking, did the carbon fibre in the middle, did it fail? Which would have then pushed the two titanium caps together. And, you know, you can imagine what happened in the middle.
I mean, questions were asked over the last few days about the safety record of this particular submersible, its structure, its construction. And those questions are going to continue, obviously, in the weeks and months to come.
Well, they will try and recover as much debris as they can. They'll go looking for all of the bits and pieces on the seafloor. One of the other intriguing points, these underwater noises, you know, what was that? Someone tapping from inside the sub. Well, we now know that those noises were spurious because an implosion like that would have produced a very large noise. And that would have been picked up by the listening devices that were put on the surface of the ocean by the rescue forces. So it's quite clear that that implosion did not occur in the time that rescue forces were on the scene. It must have happened shortly after the sub began its dive.
I've just heard somebody who's in the business saying that all tourist deep sea dives should be suspended in the short term to figure out what's going on, look at structures of other submersibles. That's the kind of thing that the experts will be looking at now, Bart.
So it's a big inflection moment for that industry, for that sector. There are relatively few deep sea submersibles that go 4,000 metres and beyond. It's almost like every one of them is bespoke, and they will have to have a look at how they regulate everything so that people can have confidence that when they get on board these things, they are as safe as possible. Because if they don't get it together, then the regulators will step in and they'll say, well, this is not something people should be doing.
Jonathan Amos. Meanwhile, another maritime tragedy, but in a different part of the world. The Spanish authorities have been accused of failing to help a boat carrying migrants, which sank whilst trying to reach the Canary Islands. At least 35 people are missing and feared dead after the boat got into trouble on Tuesday. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, has more.
Let me start with just a bit of geography to explain. The Canary Islands are just off the coast of Morocco and West Africa, but they are part of Spain, and so reaching the Canary Islands is a very popular route for migrants who want to get to a European country. And just to give you an idea, 2,000 arrived on the Canaries last month alone, but the journey is also extremely perilous. We know that last year, at least 500 people died attempting that route. Now, it seems there has been another disaster, that a dinghy sank. We're told that about 30 people are missing. And this remains a particularly controversial accident because what's been suggested is that there was a Spanish rescue boat only an hour away from where this dinghy got into trouble, and they knew it was in trouble. Now, they're saying that they handed the rescue over to Morocco, and the Moroccans took 10 hours to reach the scene. Now, the BBC has been asking the Moroccan Interior Ministry if that's true, hasn't had a response yet. Meanwhile, as all this is going on, just to give you an idea of how much of this there is, three other boats got into trouble in that same stretch of water. I'm told that more than 200 people have been rescued.
Paul Moss. As we heard in the earlier podcast, the trial of the former Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, has begun at the Supreme Electoral Court in Brasilia. Mr. Bolsonaro faces the prospect of being banned from running for public office until 2030. He's accused of abusing his powers and undermining Brazil's democracy. The charges revolve around a speech he gave during a meeting with foreign ambassadors whilst president, in which he claimed that the electronic voting machines used in October's presidential election were prone to hacking and vulnerable to fraud. I spoke to the BBC's South America correspondent, Katie Watson, who's following the story from Brasilia, and asked her to tell us more about the charges Jair Bolsonaro faces.
He wasn't in court, but what this is it's the Superior Electoral Court that is looking at, as you said, accusations of abusing power, spreading false information. And it was brought about by the Democratic Labour Party. In July last year, he gave a speech when he invited foreign diplomats to his residence here in Brasilia. And he made claims about Brazil's electronic voting system, saying that it could be hacked and it was at risk of large-scale fraud. Now, what we saw before the trial was adjourned was that the party's lawyer, he made a passionate speech saying that what he had done then was a clear attempt at a coup. It was normalising fake news. Then Mr. Bolsonaro's team stepped up and said, well, it wasn't fake news. This was a battle of narratives. In fact, they called it alternative facts. And he was just giving his opinion to the diplomats. But the public prosecutor was very clear about it. He said he was out of line. He shouldn't have said that to the ambassadors. And although he didn't win the elections, his actions did foment violence. And of course, we saw that on January the 8th when his supporters stormed buildings here in the capital, Brazil.
KT, Brazil is still very divided after that election. To what extent will his supporters see this as a politically motivated trial?
Well, as we were walking into the court earlier, there was a car and a woman shouted out, you know, long live Bolsonaro. But yes, it's deeply divided. It's quietened down an awful lot since those elections. I think some people also felt a bit kind of, you know, Bolsonaro didn't win. His supporters were sad about that. Some people felt a bit cheated by it. And there's certainly been a bit of a lull in terms of that kind of loud support, shall we say, and certainly a good thing in terms of the violence. We haven't seen violence to the extent that we saw in January. But nevertheless, there is still an awful lot of support for him and division in this country. So people here are watching this court case. Of course, it's the first of dozens of cases against Jair Bolsonaro.
Katie Watson in Brazil there. There are growing concerns about the plight of the civilian population in Sudan's Darfur region, where the rapid support forces and Arab militias are carrying out widespread atrocities. Will Ross reports.
There are two wars going on in Sudan. One, between the army and the rapid support forces, is destroying the capital Khartoum, where heavy shelling and aerial bombardment have resumed over the last few hours. In the region of Darfur, there's a war against the non-Arab population. There are now reports that RSF fighters and Arab militias are encircling the capital of North Darfur, El Fasher, cutting off the roads leading out of the city. The same tactic was deployed before El Geneina was recently overrun, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee. There is growing evidence of ethnic cleansing. Human Rights Watch says international bodies need to act fast to halt the spiralling violence and horrific abuses.
Will Ross. Now, it may be home to some of the most luxurious mansions on the planet, but one of the fastest growing communities in Los Angeles in the US is one in which many people live in their cars or motorhomes. Not in official so-called trailer parks, but simply at the side of the road without access to power or running water. 14,000 people now live like this, a 40% increase since 2018. From LA, Reagan Morris sent us this report.
I counted more than 50 motorhomes and vans parked along the busy road outside Warner Brothers Studio. Many are dilapidated and rarely have ever moved from their parking spots. A lot of the van dwellers here keep their area neat and tidy, but many more do not. There are piles of trash, an assortment of bicycles, dogs, barbecues. There's one portable toilet, but many people here don't use it. Some dump their waste from buckets into the nearby storm drains. And many of the people who live in these vans don't actually own them. They pay rent to van lords, paying anywhere from £300 to £750 a month.
Are you renting your van or do you own it?
Yeah, I rent it.
You rent it. How much do you pay, may I ask?
I don't want to say.
Okay. Liberty has been living in a camper van for more than a year. She's 44, an Army veteran, and an entrepreneur, building a motivational speaking business.
What's your experience, Ben? How is it?
Terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, like, I just stay positive and everything. And there's no water here. There's no electricity. I got my solar generator. So
the camper van Liberty calls home is significantly cheaper than renting a house or an apartment in L.A. The average cost for a one-bedroom here is nearly £2,000 a month.
This, they had to tow it because it doesn't have a motor or anything, so normally...
But the van isn't operational, so the owner tows it every few months to a new location to avoid tickets and fines. City Councilwoman Tracy Park wants to crack down on van life, or more specifically, on van lords.
Oftentimes, these vehicles are inoperable. There have been a lot of reports of explosions and fires, and we've even had some fatal RV fires here on the West Side. Our concerns are about these unscrupulous van lords who are operating illegal businesses. We've got to have a conversation about what needs to be done to keep the people safe.
And many motorhomes are not safe. Residents have died in fires started in the camper vans, and the human waste in fires have contaminated public parks.
We've lost more than 5 acres of critical habitat.
Scott Culbertson runs the Friends of Bayona Wetlands, the last coastal wetland in L.A. It's home to hundreds of birds, native plants, and one of the city's largest motorhome camps.
We've lost more than 200 mature native trees and shrubs because they've just been chopped down because they're either considered in the way or they're used for firewood. I mean, it's not safe.
I've been living here for about 2 years in this motorhome. I lived in my truck for about a year.
Richard works in construction when he can, and technically he is a van lord, though he doesn't consider himself one. He rents out his cousin's van for about £300 a month while his cousin is in jail.
Are you from L.A.? How did you end up living in the truck and then your motorhome?
Well, it's too expensive to live anywhere else. Yeah. They want, like, you know, $2,000 for rent. And then with my work, it's like it's not steady. I just couldn't find a place that was cheap enough.
And that, he says, is the reason why L.A. has so many homeless people. There just isn't enough affordable housing.
That report by Reagan Morris in Los Angeles. Still to come, in China, the capital Beijing has broken a new record.
It's very hot. 40 degrees Celsius in Beijing is, you never see temperatures like this in the city. And it's the first time that there's been a breach of the 40 degrees Celsius threshold.
Every weekday morning, wake up with an in-depth look at a single story that's affecting Africa right now.
And every weekday afternoon, wind down with three essential stories from across the continent and hear African perspectives on global news.
That's what you'll get from Africa Daily.
And Focus on Africa.
Two BBC World Service podcasts all about Africa.
And where will they find them, Alan?
Just search for Africa Daily and Focus on Africa wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
President Zelensky says Ukrainian spies have gathered intelligence suggesting that Moscow is planning an attack involving the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power station in eastern Ukraine. Russia has called this a lie, saying it recently cooperated with the International Nuclear Watchdog. Our correspondent Marnie Jones is following developments from Kyiv.
The threat of nuclear escalation is once more at the centre of the war of words between Russia and Ukraine. 2 weeks after the destruction of the Kakhovka Dam, which raised fears for the safety of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, President Zelensky says there's a new cause for concern.
Now our intelligence has received information that Russia is considering a scenario of a terrorist attack at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. A terrorist attack with radiation leakage. They have prepared everything for this.
Mr. Zelensky didn't specify what evidence he had, nor what the attack would entail. Russia's denied the allegation, pointing to a recent visit to the site by the UN's nuclear watchdog, which concluded that the station could operate safely for some time. Further south, governors appointed by Russia after its occupation of Ukrainian territory accused Kyiv of targeting one of the few routes into and out of Crimea. In social media footage verified by the BBC, two parallel road bridges that link the Kherson region to the annexed peninsula appear to have been damaged by missile strikes. Ukrainian authorities haven't confirmed their involvement. It's thought that blocking Russia's supply route from Crimea is one of the aims of Ukraine's ongoing counteroffensive.
Marnie Jones in Ukraine. The Turkish Central Bank has nearly doubled its interest rate in an effort to rein in inflation and strengthen the lira. But the currency has continued to slide, losing 4% of its value against the dollar. Theo Leggett reports.
This decision from the central bank represents a dramatic change in policy following the re-election of President Erdogan in May. In the past, he's repeatedly claimed that high inflation is the result of high interest rates, the opposite of conventional economic thinking. Bank officials who opposed this policy were dismissed on a number of occasions. But with inflation standing at nearly 40%, his new central bank governor, Hafiz Agay Erkan, appears to have been given more freedom to act. The rate hike, though dramatic, still fell short of many analysts' expectations, and the currency, the lira, fell in response.
Theo Leggett. A court in Moscow has rejected an appeal by the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich against the extension of his pre-trial detention. The American was arrested 3 months ago, accused of espionage. He is accused by Russia's FSB security service of collecting military secrets. He denies the allegations. From Moscow, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
12 weeks after he was arrested in Russia for spying, Evan Gershkovich was back in court. Along with other media, we were allowed into the courtroom for a minute and a half to see the Wall Street Journal reporter. He was locked in the dock, a cage of glass and metal. All things considered, he seems to be holding up pretty well in a very stressful situation. Later, the judge dismissed the American journalist's appeal against his detention. Gershkovich, do you understand my ruling? She asked. I do, he replied. Evan Gershkovich and the Wall Street Journal vehemently deny that he's a spy. So does the US government. Lynn Tracy, the American ambassador to Russia, was in court today.
He is an innocent journalist and has been wrongfully detained. Such hostage diplomacy is unacceptable, and we call on the Russian Federation to release him, as well as Paul Whelan, another US citizen who has been wrongfully detained. And we call for that release to occur immediately.
Immediately? Wishful thinking, perhaps. US-Russia relations are bad and getting worse over the war in Ukraine. The strained geopolitical backdrop complicates efforts to secure the release of Americans jailed in Russia.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia. Now to China, and the capital, Beijing, has recorded its hottest June day on record, with temperatures reaching 41.1 degrees Celsius, or 105.9 degrees Fahrenheit. Several monthly heat records have been broken around China this year, prompting fears of power outages. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, told James Reynolds more.
It's very hot. 40 degrees Celsius in Beijing is, you never see temperatures like this in the city. And it's the first time that there's been a breach of the 40 degrees Celsius threshold fully at all since May 2014. So it's very, very hot in the city. There have been reports of particularly elderly people being admitted to hospitals with heat stroke in Beijing in the last week. And there's an orange alert in place. That's like an emergency response. And that's the second highest alert on China's three-tier emergency system when it comes to heat. So there's a lot of messaging that's going out in the city, but also, yes, surrounding cities as well, very much warning people at the moment to drink lots of water, stay indoors if you can, and very much look after yourself and your loved ones.
Kerry, I know when you were in China, you spent time in Shanghai, time in the south, but you must know Beijing as well. What is Beijing like on a sticky day?
Actually, I lived in Chongqing for a year, which is known as one of China's furnace cities. So I know 40 degrees Celsius temperatures well, because you get them in Chongqing and a few other cities. But yeah, Beijing as well. I mean, even though it doesn't see temperatures normally that high, it is a place where, yeah, it's an urban city. Millions of people live there. It is very sticky, and you do get congestion on the subways. It's not a place that you want to be stuck in a crowd when it's warm like that. Well, I don't say warm, it's very, very hot. Big.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, there. The International Olympic Committee has withdrawn recognition from the International Boxing Association as this sport's official body. The IOC's extraordinary session rubber-stamped the executive board's recommendation over what it said was the IBA's failure to complete reforms on governance, finance and ethical issues. The IOC president, Thomas Bach, said it was not a problem the IOC could ignore.
We value the sport of boxing so much, we believe that these athletes, the boxers, fully deserve to be governed by an international federation with integrity and transparency.
The Olympic Committee had suspended the International Boxing Association 4 years ago for multiple corruption scandals. Earlier this month, the IBA slammed as abhorrent and purely political an initial recommendation from the committee's board that it be entirely stripped of its status. The boss of Twitter, Elon Musk, and the founder of Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, have apparently agreed to a cage fight. This is a form of mixed martial arts, which takes place in a cage or similarly enclosed arena. The unlikely encounter between two of the world's richest people follows reports that Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, was creating a new text-based social media site to rival Twitter. Guy Lambert takes up the story.
Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, two titans in the world of technology, who may now come face to face on a very different platform, a UFC fighting arena. It all began back in September 2016 when Mark Zuckerberg's $200 million internet.org satellite exploded in a pre-launch test fire accident on one of Elon Musk's SpaceX rockets. Since then, the two business magnates have had an ongoing dispute, and this war of words now looks as though it might take on a physical element, a cage fight in Las Vegas. Elon Musk mused on his Twitter platform that he'd be up for a cage fight if Mark Zuckerberg was, and the response from the Facebook founder was to the point. Send me location. The journalist and broadcaster Nick Pete has been covering the Ultimate Fighting Championship for 15 years, and believes the contest would only be a good thing for the profile of the sport and for charity.
got a lot of people talking about the sport of mixed martial arts that have probably never even considered it a genuine sport before. Hopefully they do get it on. Hopefully they make an absolute boatload of cash for charity. That'd be brilliant.
In recent years, the world of physical combat sports has been no stranger to such displays of dueling from non-professional athletes. In 2018, YouTubers KSI and Logan Paul took part in a white-collar boxing match, sparking a new and very lucrative trend amongst social media influencers. Logan Paul's younger brother Jake, the internet personality turned professional boxer, has today tweeted Elon Musk offering to promote the fight for charity. Despite both Musk and Zuckerberg being novices in the world of combat sports, the Facebook founder not only takes part in jiu-jitsu tournaments, but wins them. Musk tweeted he almost never works out, but he has a move called the walrus, he said, where I lie on top of my opponents and do nothing. A Meta spokesperson told the BBC the story speaks for itself.
That was Guy Lambert. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.
Hello, Nairobi.
Hello.
I said, hello, Nairobi.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Namilanta Kombo, and my BBC World Service podcast, Dear Daughter, is on the road. Here in my hometown of Nairobi in Kenya. It's the podcast where we share letters and stories and words of wisdom for daughters everywhere. And this is the second of two Dear Daughter live shows, the relationship special. So, you know what to do. Wherever you find your BBC podcast, search for Let's Do It Everyone. Search for 1, 2, 3.
Dear Daughter!